Series of studies that we simply entitled Evidence for Faith. There will be 11 lessons in the series. We gave our reasons for the need for that series in our last study. And if you'd like to reference that, you can go back and get the CD of that. The audio will be posted soon of both of all the lessons as they are being presented on our website, elbethelchurchofchrist.com, and as well as the PowerPoint that you'll be looking at for Lord's Day evening and tonight as well. If you would like to receive, several have asked for the material that you see on the screen. If you'd like to have that in electronic form, send me an email and I will forward that to you and we'll make all of that available to you. Tonight we're going to continue our study of evidence for God. We looked at evidence for God in our last study. We'll say more about that in just a moment. Next, Lord's Day evening, we're going to talk about the problem of evil. That's one reason we're not doing the fifth Sunday. We felt that continuing the continuity of this series and the need for it and the interest in it needed to flow and continue. Then we're going to talk about the Bible and science. We're going to talk about creation, and then we'll talk about the Genesis flood and archaeology, and then we'll get into Jesus and his being historical, and whether or not there was a real Jesus, and furthermore, his resurrection from the dead. That'll be the heart of the study. And then we'll talk about the inspiration and canonization of the Scriptures. Let's go back and remind ourselves of the kind of proof that is available. Can we prove that there is a God? And the answer to that is yes. Is there evidence of the existence of God? And the answer to that is yes. The kind of proof that we can offer is not demonstrative proof. But that is, we cannot go into outer space, and therefore we see God setting off to the side on the throne, and there he is. And so we send a spaceship up, and we take a camera, and we saw him, and we see him, and now we can send another spaceship, and we can touch him. And then we can interact with him, and we talk with him, and therefore we know there is a God. It's not demonstrative proof. We can show it is more reasonable to believe in God than to not believe in God. Bert Thompson said it well. He said, the theist advocates, we read this quote last time, the view that evidence is available to prove conclusively that God does exist and the evidence is adequate to establish beyond reasonable doubt the existence of God. However, when I employ the word prove, I do not mean God's existence can be demonstrated scientifically. In the same fashion that one might prove a sack of potatoes weighs 10 pounds and the human heart has four distinct chambers within it. Those can be demonstrated or given with demonstrative proof. But not so with the evidence of the existence of God. So last time we looked at evidence for God, part one, where we talked about how the Bible passages argue from creation. Psalm 19, Romans chapter 1 are two primary passages that argue from creation that there is a God, just looking at creation. We talked about the cosmological and teleological argument, that is, the argument from a cause. There is an uncaused first cause, and then we talked about the argument from design. Let's continue our study tonight, and let's talk about atheism's non-design response to that. I plan to deal with this a little bit later in the series, but perhaps it fits better here with the design argument that we made in our last study, fresh on our minds, that the atheists respond to that. Well, we talked in that lesson, if you were not here, how that the complexity and the design of the universe and the human body argues for a designer. When you look at the human eye and how it functions, when you look at the circulatory system of the body, when you look at even the hand and how it functions, that argues that there was an intelligent designer behind that, and therefore there is a God who created all things. The atheist argues from a non-design perspective, and that's their response. Richard Dawkins, in his book called The Blind Watchmaker, he argues for this non-design concept when he talks about this is his subtitle is why the evidence of evolution reveals the universe without design. And he focuses on the non-design aspect of creation and the world around us. He wouldn't call it creation. And suggests from that that there is not a God. Their argument is a two-pronged approach. First, they say that the design that we talk about is apparent. It is not actual. To them, what appears to be design can be explained on the basis of adaptations, random chance operations over eons of time. And so this hand that has the design that we talk about, that if there were a mechanical hand that can do all that our hand does, we'd say there's a designer behind it. But there wasn't a designer behind the human hand. It has evolved over a period of eons of time. It has to be not millions, but billions and billions of years for that to all evolve. And that all was done by chance. The design is apparent. It is not actual, they argue. The second prong of their approach in response to us, they talk about poor design. And perhaps they spend more time there. They talk about poor design, and that is, they talk about what things it would not be present if there was an intelligent designer. Their argument goes thus, that if design proves the existence of God, then poor design disproves the same God, they say. That is, if you look at the human body and you're saying there is design, if that argues for a God, then poor design would also disprove that same God. So there is just as much proof there is not a God from design as there is proof there is a God, they would argue. So they tell us that there are things that are suboptimal. And they argue from that standpoint that if all design is perfect by a perfect designer, then everything in the world would be optimal. But things in the world are not optimal, therefore there is no God. Let's see how their argument goes. As we talk about that argument, I want us to look and see how that's flawed. What is the flaw behind the non-design argument? Well, first of all, I want to suggest to you that the theist is not obligated to show obvious design in every single feature of the universe. Now, get that carefully. When somebody wants to point out some so-called, and I put in quotations, a flaw in design, that we as the creationist and the theist are not obligated to show the obvious design in every single feature of the universe. What I can show is there is design in the human body. There is design in the universe. There is design in the creation. There is not always the obvious design in everything. It is not my obligation to explain the design of every single feature of the universe. It is possible that an object could possess a purposeful design that we have not yet recognized. We may not presently know the design, but with further research and further study, what may cause us to discover there is a design behind that. Let me give you an example. Stephen Jay Gould wrote a book called The Panda's Thumb. His book argued that the panda's thumb is very clumsy and not well designed. It would be more functional if it was like that of a human, he argued. And thus that proves that the all-wise creator did not design. There is not an all-wise creator who designed the panda because the panda's thumb is quite short and clumsy and is not fully developed. So here is poor design. And that is as much evidence then there is not a God. Let's respond to that. Bert Thompson, in his book on the case for the existence of God, said on page 147, he gave these quotations. He quotes from San Diego's zoo's giant panda zoo book that in fact the giant panda is one of the few large animals that can grab things as tightly as humans can with this so-called flawed thumb. The giant pandas of Wolong, scholars said, the panda can handle bamboo stems with great precision by holding them as if with forceps in the hairless groove connecting the pad of the first digit and the pseudo-thumb. What I'm giving you is quotations from those who have, with their research, discovered there is some design behind that. But Stephen Jay Gould says, and he argues, that that's a flawed design. Well, Cal Budd, in his work on the panda's thumb, published in Apologetics Press, and by the way, this is a picture he himself made of this panda as he's working through some bamboo. And let's read Kyle's reference to the panda and his study about the panda. Responding to Stephen Jay Gould, he said, what Gould did not understand is that the panda's thumb is perfectly designed to do the job it needs to do. Sure, the panda can't use the thumb to write a letter or screw the lid on a peanut butter jar, but its thumb is ideal for the holding bamboo. In fact, the clumsy thumb of the panda can hold bamboo in a grip so tight it's like a vice. This allows the panda to strip the bamboo of its leaves and stems. This is good for the panda because it spends about 12 hours every day eating about 50 pounds of food. In the wild, almost all the food the panda eats is bamboo. They rarely eat anything else. And we see that their thumb is not an example of bad design. Instead, God designed the palm to have the perfect tool to needed to eat the bamboo all day long. What I'm trying to suggest to you is, you may see something, and the scientist may see something, and the atheist may see something in the universe they can't claim as poor design. But that does not suggest that indeed it is poor design. Those who claim something is suboptimal set themselves up as the sole judge of what is and what is not optimal. For example, when they take the panda and they say the thumb is suboptimal, it is poor design, they have set themselves up as the sole judge of what is optimal and what is not. That we will determine what is optimal and what is not. And I want to suggest to you that all of that is based upon assumption. We're going to talk about assumption more when we get into creation. But the argument of the non-design, that is, that's the atheist response to the design or argument that we made. This whole concept of the suboptimal or non-design concept is all based upon assumption, and that's what they think. This is an atheist, an evolutionist, himself admitting that. Listen to this. Douglas Futama. He said, the case for evolution has two sides. Positive evidence, that is, evolution has occurred, and negative evidence that the natural world does not conform to our expectations of what an omnipotent, omniscient, truthful creator would have created. See what he's saying? He's saying we have rejected the idea of a God because what we see in the universe is not what we think he should have done. Their arguments are based upon assumption. We'll talk more about assumption a little bit later. We're still responding to the non-design argument. What we're seeing, what is called non-design, is actually what we might label as degeneration. Let's talk about degeneration. What's going on? Warren Ryder illustrated it thus. Suppose you find an old book in a pile of garden rubbish. It's been there for a while. It is weathered. The pages are all stuck together. The type is faded. It is practically illegible. The question is, does the current condition of the book mean that it was never legible? Would you look at that book and say, this book was poorly designed because whoever put this book out, the type is not clear, the pages are all stuck together. Does the current condition argue that that's the way it has always been? Well, obviously not. You recognize that. Well, the Bible tells us that creation suffers, Romans chapter 8. All creation suffers. All mankind is suffering, Romans chapter 8. Perhaps you're more interested in this passage that Hebrews chapter 1 talks about how the earth and the world and the universe is wearing out. We'll talk about that when we get into evolution and creation. The world is wearing down. It's literally wearing out like a garment. And so if evolution be correct, and we'll get more into that a little bit later, everything ought to be building up and getting better and improving with time. But actually what's going on is it's wearing out and wearing down. Well, what might be seen and viewed as non-design or that which is suboptimal in creation may actually be the world just simply wearing out, wearing down. You remember Genesis chapter 2 and in verse 17 that when God gave a law to man in the very beginning that in the day they would eat of it, they would surely die physically. So death and disease that goes along with death is a consequence to sin. So what I learned from that is this, that when we see things like heart disease and eye problems and cancer does not mean that we're not fearfully and wonderfully made, Psalm 139 and verse 14. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. But when someone incites, well, man has heart problems, so that shows a flawed design. It doesn't show a flawed design at all. What we're seeing is degeneration. Not only is the world wearing out, but because man has sinned, then we have death that has entered upon the world, and consequently we deteriorate. And so we're dying. And we do die, and we have disease, and we have eye problems, and we have cancer, and on down the line. What the atheist has done is they blame God for man's mistakes. And so that's like going and finding this book in the rubbish and you say that it's the publisher's fault is why the pages are all stuck together and the type is blurred and we can't read a thing in that. When actually what you're seeing is degeneration. And that's what we're experiencing in the world. Well, there's more could be said about the non-design response of atheism, but that fits with our study last week. Let's talk about the moral argument. I want you to follow this carefully. We're trying to give evidence, external evidence. We can go to the Bible and prove from the Bible, and we're going to do that as the series continues. But we're trying to deal with what we might label as external evidence that argues for the existence of God. I want to suggest to you, first of all, that man's moral nature argues for a moral architect, a moral designer, and a moral governor. Man has an innate capacity to know and choose between right and wrong, or at least what he thinks is right and what he thinks is wrong. Universally, man, and even atheists, appeal to a standard of morality, whether they like to admit it or not. In every society, in every tribal community, you will hear things worded like this. Someone may say, "That's mine, you can't have it." Not appealing to a Bible text. Or even saying, "Because there is a God, I want to tell you that you're not to take that." But there is a sense of fairness, a sense of morality. "That is mine, you can't take that." Or it may be something like, "How would you like it if someone had done that to you?" That's arguing for some code of morality. Or they may argue that something is not fair, or you promised, you made a deal. It'd be interesting to toy with an atheist somewhat by trying to ask them to do something and see if they ever tell you, "Well, that's not fair." I'd like to have a debate with an atheist and tell him, "You can have 30 minutes and then I'll have an hour for every 30 minutes you have." If he argues that's not fair, he's arguing for a moral code. If there is no sense of fairness, then I'll do what I want to and I'll leave you to do what you need. That doesn't work. So man always argues for a sense of moral code. Listen to A.E. Taylor in his book, Does God Exist? He said man may draw the line between right and wrong in a different place, but at least they all agree that there is such a line to be drawn. So our focus is not on where does man draw the line, but that man agrees a line is to be drawn on what is moral and what is not moral, what is right and what's not right. Universally, that is the case. So I ask this question. Why should man be concerned with the demands of conscience, if he is nothing more than a chance combination of atoms? The atheist says that all man is a chance combination of atoms and from some Big Bang or by chance everything working out over eons of time, and now we've ended up with man. So why should that man, who is nothing but a combination of atoms that have come together, this chance combination of atoms, why should he be at all concerned with his conscience and with what is right and what is wrong, and why should he be making choices? That's a good question to answer. I want to suggest to you that man is unique. There is no other creature that has an inner moral sense. An ox gores a man to death. The ox has no remorse. He will not be arrested and he will not be tried. Can you imagine? An ox was arrested today and he'll be put on trial for the murder of so-and-so. He is not guilty of murder. When we go out and talk to the ox and tell him you shouldn't have done that, there is no remorse. Nor does he justify it at all. He's not a moral character. The dog takes another dog's bone. He experiences no remorse. Because they are not moral characters. Man is a unique being. Man has the ability to make choices. And he has the ability to choose between right and wrong. And so I raise the question, from whence did this sense of morality come? From whence did this sense of morality come? It cannot come from matter, because matter is neither moral nor spiritual. Do you really believe that the man's sense of morality, difference between right and wrong, came from matter? Something has to be eternal. We'll talk about that a little more later in our series. It could not come from matter, because matter is neither moral nor spiritual. Intelligence is both moral and spiritual. And what I'm proposing to you is it is more reasonable to believe that it came from God, who is that moral architect. Now I'm left with two choices. Man is a moral being who's making moral decisions. That sense of morality either came from matter that is eternal, or it came from an intelligent designer who is God. Which is more reasonable to believe? I told you we're not giving demonstrative proof because it cannot be given. But we can show it's far more reasonable to believe in God than to reject that there is a God. Let's talk about C.S. Lewis, who died 52 years ago today. From the Magdalen College of Oxford University. Why do we mention C.S. Lewis? Well, he was once an atheist and an agnostic. He rejected the idea of God. And he became one of the most effective apologists. If you're not familiar with apology, we're not talking about saying I'm sorry. That's a defender of his belief. Defending the idea there is a God. He was an apologist. Became very effective at that. Wrote many books on that. But what's interesting is the fact that in his book, Mere Christianity, he gives moral law, the very argument we're making, as evidence for the existence of God. And part of the evidence that caused him to come from an unbeliever, an atheist or agnostic, to becoming a believer in God and being a defender of that. Not just partially believing in that, but believing in so strong he tries to defend that, and he does in his works. He argues thus. He says that there is a moral law that is more than an instinct within man. The atheists have argued, well, what you're calling the moral law is just a natural instinct. Just like the dog that has puppies, the mother has an instinct to care for the puppies. That's what you're talking about, is the moral instinct. A natural instinct, not a moral instinct, but a natural instinct. He gives this illustration. This is Lewis's illustration. Of a man standing on a bank of some swift water, and he sees a guy about to drown in the water. There's going to be two to three things that are going to happen. First, there's going to be the impulse, the desire to jump in and save the man. But that's not all that he's going to think about. Because the bank is high and the water is swift, there's going to be the second impulse, the desire to avoid the danger, because he could get hurt himself and maybe drown himself, and so maybe he'll not help at all. And Lewis illustrates by saying that there's actually a third thing that's going to take place, and there's something within him that tells him to follow the impulse to help and suppress the impulse to run away. And no animal can make that decision. That's a moral decision. That's a choice between right and wrong and what he should do. No animal can make that decision. The mother may have a natural instinct to care for her child. That is, the dog cares for the pup, and the horse cares for its foal, and the cow cares for her calf. But that's not a moral decision like this man is making. Man has a choice. And often man acts upon the weaker of the impulses. Did you get that point? That's a strong point, Lewis points out. That often in making those decisions, that he wants to help the man, but he wants to avoid danger, and he acts upon that which is the weaker impulse rather than the stronger impulse. Because he's making a moral decision. And that argues with the fact that there is a universal being. So, Lewis concludes, that the sense of ought within man, that moral law within man, demonstrates that there is a moral, ethical being behind the universe that planted that within man. Now let's move to the fact that the atheists have a burden of proof here. We're still talking about the moral law within. The atheists have a burden of proof. They must demonstrate how a moral, responsible being could have come from purely materialistic source. Sometimes those of the atheistic concept want to put the burden of proof completely upon us, that we have to prove there is a God and we can't prove there is a God, they say. Well, I think I can, and I will. And I think you can. And if you want to, you will. But there's a burden of proof upon the atheist. And that is what he needs to prove is he needs to demonstrate how a morally responsible being like man can come from a purely materialistic source, from matter. Please tell me that, Mr. Professor. Tell me how that from matter comes a moral, responsible being like man who makes moral decisions like the one Lewis illustrated. Secondly, the atheist must contend that raw, eternal, inorganic matter, yes, eternal, inorganic matter, was able by means of an extended evolutionary process to concoct and promote and maintain morality. You want to talk about a leap of faith? The atheist picture as if we've taken from nothing, we just make a leap of faith and we somehow believe in God. That's not true. But you want to talk about a leap of faith that you believe that matter is eternal, it's inorganic, and from that, matter has somehow developed into a sense of morality. Please, Mr. Atheist, explain that for us. The fact is that infidelity, by that we mean atheism, cannot explain the origin of morality nor the origin of ethics. And yet the theist and the creationist can. The so-called Christian thinker, Francis Schaffner, once had a conversation with several of his students. One who disagreed with Schaffner's moral objectivism. The student believed that ultimately there's no difference between cruelty and non-cruelty. Another student listening went and got a hot tea kettle full of hot boiling water and held it over that student's head and said, "There is no difference between cruelty and non-cruelty," getting ready to pour it, and that student got up and left. Now, the fallacy of the argument, that didn't work too well, did it? They don't really believe that. They believe there's a moral code. Let's move on to another point. Let's talk about the universal belief in God. I want to suggest to you that all nations and all men believe in a supreme being. And someone would be quick to say there are atheists in the world. There are exceptions. But what I'm arguing for is not all people believe in the one true God. That's not our point. What I want to suggest to you is that all men and all nations believe in a supreme being. They believe in some deity. And they worship. Religion dominates their thoughts and dominates their history. The human heart has a craving for God. We'll see that even in the text here in just a moment. The human heart has a craving for God Himself. Listen to a couple of quotations. Robert Flynn is quoted by Dixon in The Fall of Unbelief. An excellent book, by the way, if you choose to read it. An impartial examination of the relevant facts, it appears to me, shows that religion is virtually universal. Not Christianity universal. That's not what he's arguing. Not necessarily believing in the one true living God, but the religion is universal. Now, let's go further. C.H. Troy, in the Introduction to the History of Religion, said, "As far as our present knowledge goes, religion appears to be universal among men." So what does that mean? Well, if God does not exist, then matter has produced a false idea that God does exist. Again, we have to go back to matter, which is eternal, according to the atheist. Something is eternal. It has to be either mind or matter. They say it's matter. I say it's mind. I say it's intelligence. I say it's God. It's eternal. But they say it's matter. If God does not exist, then matter has produced a false idea that God does exist. How did that happen? You see, if God exists, we have an adequate cause for the effect. The effect is that religion is universal. Man has a craving for God. Man has a craving for worship. Man has religion universally. If there is a God, I have an explanation for that. If there is not a God and God does not exist, we do not have an adequate cause for the effect. Where'd that come from? Mr. Atheist, tell us where that came from. Here's the conclusion that we have to draw. That there is a supreme being who created within man the attributes of a higher being and worship. Now let's open our Bibles. I said we'd come back to the text here in just a moment. We're not spending a great deal of time in our text because we're trying to give some external evidence. Let's turn to Acts the 17th chapter. Paul came to Mars Hill and he began to preach and he noticed that they had an inscription to the unknown God. They didn't know the one true and the living God. And he said, "That's the God I want to declare unto you." So he preaches about the one true and living God. That's what we're talking about here tonight. Beginning at verse 26. That he did, and he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth and has determined the pre-appointed times and the bounds of their habitation so that they should seek the Lord and hope that they may grope for Him and find Him, though He be not far from each one of us. Now, I want you to get the quotation. Let me just ask for emphasis. Is that not talking about this craving that man has for religion and for God? The very universal belief in a God? Where did it come from? Well, let's go back to verse 26. He has made of one blood of nations men to dwell on the face of the earth and has determined to forward the times and the boundaries of their habitation. Now, verse 27, that they should seek the Lord and hope that they might grope for Him or find Him, though He be not far from every one of us. The argument we're making is that there was a universal belief in God. And therefore, where did that come from? That either came from matter that produced a false impression of God, or there is a supreme being that explains the fact that he placed within man this craving for God and for religion and for worship. But finally, let's talk about the beliefs of atheism. We have two alternatives. We can believe in God and become a theist, or we can be an atheist. We don't believe in God. That's the only two choices we have. Nothing wrong with questioning, do I have real evidence for my faith? But when I get to the point I'm beginning to reject evidence so that I'm beginning to wonder, is there really a God? The only other alternative I have is to go to the point I do not believe in God. I'm an atheist then, or an agnostic to say the least. I want to suggest to you the atheist is a believer. Oh yes, he's a believer. He believes, but he cannot prove that God does not exist. And by his own admission, he cannot prove that. He cannot give some kind of demonstrative proof that God does not exist. So he believes, though he says himself, at least many of them do, they cannot prove that God does not exist, but they believe that. They are believers. You remember that when the atheists ridicule you for your faith and as if it's a blind leap into the dark, you remember that and ask your atheist friend or professor about their blind leap. Ask them about that. The atheist is a believer. He believes in the eternal existence of matter. He ridicules you for believing, or she ridicules you for believing that God is eternal. You really believe there is an eternal God? Well, Mr. Professor, you believe that matter is eternal. He has to. He believes that matter is eternal. He believes in the eternal existence of matter. He believes in the spontaneous generation of life from non-life. You're talking about a leap of faith? You want to talk about a blind leap into the dark? The atheists need to be nudged on that heavily. They believe that order evidences in nature, that is, the order that we see in nature, that we talked about in the design, is a result of mere chance. That all just happened. So the things we talked about in our study last time, the heart and how it functions properly, the eye and how it focuses, and the hand how it works, and the hearing how it works, all of that is just mere chance. You'll talk about a blind leap. The atheist indeed is a believer. He believed that consciousness arose out of non-conscious matter. Your sense of morality, your consciousness, arose out of non-conscious matter. The atheist believes also that man is a machine without responsibility for his conduct. He believes that man has no moral values. He may argue for moral values, but he says that man has no moral values. I want to contrast some views in closing. We have the creationist and the theist on the one side and the atheist and the skeptic on the other. And I said we only have two choices. Either you're going to believe and become a theist, or you're going to be an atheist and a skeptic. The atheist, or the Christian on the one side, or the theist, believes that God is involved in history. That much of what we can account for in our past, and we'll talk about this when we come to the Genesis flood, there are many things that are going to be explained only by the Genesis flood. God is involved in history. The atheist says there is no God, there's no referee, there's no umpire. There's nothing involved, there's no being involved in history. The theist believes that man is in God's image. The atheist and the skeptic believes that man is a graduate beast. That you're just like an animal, that's all you are, just kind of a higher form of animal, but you're no different than an ape, or a cow, or a dog, or a cat. You're just a graduated form of a beast. The theist believes that God is the authority. The atheist believes man is his highest authority. Man is his own authority. Hence comes humanism. To the theist, God's word is the standard. To the atheist, truth is relative. There is no sense of right or wrong. Are you getting indoctrinated a little bit about there is no sense of right and wrong? Are you getting a dose of that in school? Are you getting a dose of that in university, high school, television? That all is relative, there is no sense of right and wrong, and the only person that's wrong in the world is the person that says he thinks he's right. The root of that is atheism, friend. That's where that's coming from. Because there is no standard of right versus wrong. It's all relative. Relativism comes from atheism. The theist believes God created the universe. The atheist believes the universe happened by chance. The theist believes that man is a worshiping being. The atheist believes that the desire for worship is a sign of immaturity. All of us who come out on Sundays and we devote our time and we worship, we haven't grown up and we haven't matured and we haven't learned what they know. They are enlightened and we're the idiots. That's their belief. We're immature. That's the contrasted views. Well, that's enough for tonight. We're going to talk in our next study about have the atheists proved there is no God and their claim that the presence of evil, that if there is a God and He is the all-powerful God and He's the all-loving God, then why does evil exist? And that's a strong argument they make. Thomas Warren said that's the strongest argument they've ever made. He's met it much in debate, and so we'll look at those arguments and talk about the problem of evil. Well, tonight we've considered the atheist non-design argument, the moral argument, the universal belief in God, and then the problems of the belief of atheism. Now, as we did last week, about 10 minutes after we dismiss, we'll go to the young adult classroom for those who want to come, young people, parents, anybody that wants to come. We had a good number show up last week for a question and answer period, because in a more private setting there may be some questions that somebody wants to ask they wouldn't ask in a public setting. And so we'll have that question and answer period here in just a few moments. There may be one or more present this evening who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and while we sing?